From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The concept of embalming a body is pretty much the same today as it was in ancient Egypt. You're preserving someone who's died. But the bioanthropologist Heather Gilfrerking says the function may be the same, but there's a big difference. Today, we preserve a body for the sake of the family, to keep it intact through the process of mourning and disposition. But for the Egyptians, it was about keeping the body whole while the body made the journey to another dimension. It was crucial. Gilfrerking is one of the curators of the Mummies of the World exhibit, which is opening in Salt Lake City this week. And today in the program, we're talking about mummies, the stories of some of them in the exhibit, and the questions of why we made mummies, why we keep them, and, of course, why we're so fascinated by them. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So not everyone is fascinated by mummies, but let's be honest, most of us are. And we have our reasons. Some are intrigued by being so close to history. Some like learning about ancient cultures and practices. Some just like seeing the bodies, various shapes and positions and various stages of decomposition. And today in the program, we're talking about mummies. The exhibition Mummies of the World is opening this week in Salt Lake City. It includes 40 mummies from different places and times, along with other objects, other specimens. There are mummies from Egypt, of course, from Asia, from South America. There are children mummies. There are animal mummies. Some, like the Egyptian ones, were deliberate. Others are natural, bodies found in ice or bogs. We're talking about the mummies and some of the stories in the exhibit today, but also what they can teach us and, of course, why we're so fascinated by them. We hope you'll join us today. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Heather Gilfrerking is joining us here. She's a biological anthropologist and the director of science and education for the Mummies of the World exhibit. She's also editor of the forthcoming book, Mummy Studies. She's joining us here in the studio. And welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
S.J. Wolf is also with us. She's a senior cataloger at the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's created a database of all known Egyptian mummies in North America. She's the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America, joining us today from her office there in Worcester. And S.J. Wolf, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Mummies of the World opens this weekend at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Well, I guess I wanted to start, Heather Gilfrerking, with you and S.J. Wolf about your own interest in mummies. Heather Gilfrerking, you first. Have you always been fascinated by mummies? How did you come to this?
Actually, this kind of came to me late in life. I was going to university. I was studying to be a primary school teacher. I went on and qualified and decided maybe that wasn't my career preference. I got really excited about bog mummies from Northern Europe. So I became aware of the tomb.
Wait, how? Just you were...
Well, I have Danish heritage, and I'd been to Denmark, and I had the chance to see these amazing mummies that have been preserved for 2,000 years and look like they've been put in the bog yesterday. And I asked people, well, how does this work? And they kept telling me, well, we don't know. And I'm one of those horrible people that if you say, well, we don't know, I have to go find the answer.
Yeah.
And so I've been researching that side of things ever since. And kind of from that point on, it spiraled. I learned that mummification is just this really wide area and wanted to learn more and more about it.
Mm. So, Dr. Wolf, your fascination started when you saw a child mummy at a hospital. Did I get that right?
No. sort of. It's very convoluted.
Yeah.
I was a child, and I saw a mummy case.
Got it.
At an art museum in Springfield, Massachusetts. And I was perhaps 3 or 4 years old, and my grandfather and I went to the museum frequently. And this thing, this object, this brightly painted object just captivated me. And it started a lifelong interest in ancient Egypt, but as I did more and more reading, I realized that it was really the mummies themselves that fascinated me.
Mm.
And so it really has been pretty much a lifelong, for over 50 years, a lifelong interest of mine. And I started indulging it when I went to college, and that was right about the time of the first Tutankhamun exhibition in the United States. And it's sort of snowballed from there. Mm.
Can you say what it is? What is it? It's more than the history, it seems. It's more than just your interest in culture, although I'm sure that's a big part of it. But you were also interested in the artifact itself, the body itself, weren't you?
Yes. I was trying to find out how – the mummy's name is Patty Hirschef that started all of this. I wanted to know how he got to the United States and how he got to Mass General Hospital and how he got separated from his coffin. And I discovered that there weren't any answers. Nobody had ever written about the history of Egyptian mummies as artifacts. There was tons of information about what they did when they were alive, but there was nothing about them as artifacts. And I'd always kind of had a secret wish to be an archaeologist, and I thought, okay, I can't actually go and dig, but I can try to find references. I can try to find information. And that's what I started to do. And thank God for digital resources, because I could not have done the research that I've been able to do without having newspapers, periodicals, books, magazines digitized and available for research.
So for you, it's not enough just to see this intriguing desiccated corpse. You want the context for it. You want to know the story.
Right. I want to know the provenance behind it. Yeah. How did it get here? What happened to it? Some of these mummies were pretty badly treated, and I'm surprised they've survived. I mean, Patty Hirschef was the first mummy to be exhibited in 1823, and he's one of the few early ones that's survived to the present day. We don't really know what happened to the rest of them.
So for the rest of us, people who are coming to who will be coming to this exhibit, for example, I guess we all, as I mentioned in the introduction, we all have different kinds of reasons. But what is it that fascinates us in general with mummies? Heather, you said something to us earlier this week. You said part of it is that a mummy defies our expectations in the sense that, you know, you expect dust to dust. You expect decomposition. And a mummy is there. It stays there.
Right. The wonderful thing about a mummy is that it doesn't go through those normal processes of decay. And we talk about that a lot in the exhibition. People expect that after death, your body will decompose and go away and we won't exist. But the wonderful thing about the mummies that we have that exist today is that as long as they're cared for properly, they'll still exist in 500 or 1,000 years, even if I'm not physically here. And the chance to look at what processes lead to that, the fact that it defies everything that we expect, everything we know will happen with our own body, I think really gives people insight into what else is out there and is maybe a little thought-provoking.
Mm. Our modern embalming tradition, what's the connection? Is there any relationship between – I mean, we embalm bodies now. You know, we fill the veins full of a fluid and preserve them. So is there any real relationship between that process now and the process, say, in Egypt, for example?
One of the things I think that is really exciting to think about is who is the preservation for?
Yeah.
And so we look at whether the mummification was for the individual who has died or for the people who are left behind. And I think modern embalming to some extent is for those who are left behind, leaving the body in such a form that we have time to mourn. We have time to go through that process of allowing the person into the next world. But a lot of ancient bodies were prepared for that individual to go into the afterlife. You needed to have your body intact to go into the Egyptian afterlife, for example. In other cases, in South America, we know it was quite common that ancestors are brought out on feast days. They're paraded through town. They're consulted for advice. So the important thing about preserving bodies, whether it's modern embalming or ancient bodies that are naturally preserved or artificially preserved, is who was it for? What was the intention? There are
and it's for us, right? It's for the people left behind.
In some cases,
yeah.
But not always.
Right.
Sometimes it was for that person that died. So I think it's really important to stop and think about what the intention is. Some of these people would have known that they would be preserved for long periods of time. Others would never have known. The bog mummies of Northern Europe, for example, they would never have known that they would have existed 2,000 years later. And so we have these wonderful bodies that we can go back to, but they would never have known that existed. So
And didn't intend for that.
They didn't intend for that necessarily. The ancient Egyptians, they saw the naturally preserved bodies that came out of the sand and said, well, we can do that process. We can replicate that process. It took them a while to get it right,
yeah.
But they can do that to keep those bodies living for long, long periods of time after death.
I think Heather's right there that it depends on the point of view, who is the embalming, who is the preservation for. Modern American embalming really became commonplace during the Civil War when soldiers died far from home and there was no way to bring the bodies back for the family to grieve or to mourn. And it's really interesting if you look at the coffins of that time period. They have face plates or they have a viewing port where the person can be seen. And so I think today embalming is for those of us who are left behind. It's also, in a way, easing the passage to death. Death doesn't become abrupt, cut off, and poof, you're gone. It becomes a way to ease into the idea of death. We don't talk about many people dying. They passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he's gone. He's gone to a better life.
Yeah.
Death is a really intriguing concept to people. It's scary. It's unknown. And I think part of the whole fascination with mummies is that these are dead bodies you can look at without thinking, oh, my God, that's a family member.
So it's interesting. We still have this, for the Egyptians, it was important that the body remain whole and become intact. But I guess you would figure that over time our ideas would change. But in some ways they really haven't. We still need some sort of transition. And in some ways, it's about grief, and in some ways, it's about us. And I think, Dr. Wolf, you had mentioned that seeing your own mother, that you had some comfort, that seeing her body provided some comfort for you yourself.
Because she had been very, very ill and looked it. And when they embalmed her and prepared her in her casket, she looked 20 years younger, and she looked beautiful.
Yeah.
She looked like she was asleep. And I think that is a help to modern people. But I still think part of the attraction for mummies of any sort is these are dead bodies that it's okay to look at. It's okay to be curious about them. You don't really want to be that curious about the body of a relative in a coffin, but these bodies are long dead, and it's okay to be curious about them.
So what's that impulse? Because I think it's interesting. I'm thinking about plastination, for example. In fact, the Body Worlds exhibit was at the Leonardo book a couple of years ago, and I get the part where you're like, oh, this is really interesting because it teaches us about anatomy. This is how the muscle system works, or this is how the vascular system works. And I understand that, but can you really ever separate that from the more kind of voyeuristic impulse that we just want to see a dead body?
No, I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the people who flock to scenes of accidents and rubberneck at an automobile accident or something.
I think SJ is right about that. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the thing with these mummies is that for most of these people, they are several hundred or several thousand years old, and it's really a window into, this is how I live my life today, but I can tell you enough about these people, about how they lived their lives then, that you can sit down and go, these people lived exactly the same. They had to get up every day and work. They had to look after their children. They had to care for their families. They did everything that we do today. And I think aside from being able to view them as the dead individual that they are, you get a chance to view them as the people that they are. And I know SJ is comfortable with referring to mummies as artifacts. I have a harder time doing that. To me, these are still people, and we have to treat them with that respect.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
There just wasn't – it was kind of a hard word. I didn't like the word bodies.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, they are artifacts to many people. And if you see them in a museum setting, they are as much an artifact as any other artifact that's there. But there is that, and Heather's very right, that underlying thing that this is a human body. It needs to be treated with respect. And I think this is what's driving the movement now, where some museums are not displaying human remains.
And I note that the International Council of Museums has just released their 2013 Code of Ethics for museums, and they have new information in there about displaying sensitive subjects such as human remains and how to do that appropriately and respectfully and be aware of the wishes of the public, but also to take into account the wishes of the cultures from which these bodies may have originated. And this is a really important thing that we have to look at.
You know, the thing I was thinking about, too, is that in many ways – a bone isn't enough. When you see and you can see this on a number of these mummies, calluses, scars,
fingerprints, toenails.
Yep. I mean, that's another dimension.
Yeah, acne, smallpox scars.
Yeah.
You see all this. I meant to ask Heather if, when we were talking about respect, do you recite life, prosperity, and health to your mummies?
I don't.
Wait, what does that mean?
Go ahead, Esther.
Well, it's a formula to give the mummy life in the afterlife. You can say to them, you can say the mummy's name, Patty Hersheff, life, prosperity, and health. To speak the mummy's name is a way of making that mummy live in the afterlife. I do this to every mummy that I see. It's a it's a mark of respect.
Wow.
And understanding,
I thought I was weird, but
No. Understanding that we only have one Egyptian mummy for which we know the name, and although I could apply it generally, many of our mummies we don't have the actual name, and I think it's inappropriate to give mummies nicknames. There's a tendency in the media, for example, to give them nicknames, and that's not appropriate. They had a name in life, so I don't give them a name, but where I can be as respectful as possible, I will.
Yeah, I don't like nicknames either. I think that that's my teeth on edge, because it isn't their name.
Right.
Especially Egyptian mummies, for whom the name was almost as important as the body. If the body didn't survive, the name could survive, and that person could still survive in the afterlife.
That's right.
I want to talk about that when we get back from a break, because I think that's interesting. The idea, something had to be in place of the person, right? There had to be. Well, we'll talk about this when we get back from a break. S.J. Wolfe is with us, the author of Mummies in 19th Century America. Heather Gill Frerking is the Science and Education Director with the Mummies of the World exhibit, which opens this Saturday at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Join us if you'd like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about mummies. There's a new exhibit at the Leonardo in Salt Lake City with all kinds of mummies. And so we're talking about the cultural importance, the process, discussing what mummies teach us about people and in another time and another place. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Heather Gill Frerking, I guess not all ancient cultures did this, and I guess the real pros were the Egyptians, right? I mean, is that true?
Well, I think that's a matter of opinion. There are a lot of Egyptologists that would say that's absolutely the case. But I think when we look at other cultures, you know, mummies were mummified in Papua New Guinea by smoking them. So they were stretched out on a ladder and stuffed sometimes with grasses, sometimes left intact, and they would be smoked. Those mummies are beautifully well-preserved. The Chinchorro of South America date back as far as 7,000 years ago. They were mummifying long before the Egyptians had taken on the technique. And the Chinchorro has mummified even fetuses who had been stillborn. So everybody in their community was important enough to be mummified, and that was followed through. So although the Egyptians are considered the experts and they really did refine these really beautiful techniques, they certainly were not necessarily the first and not necessarily the best. Sometimes the environment is the best mummification method.
And Egypt was dry.
Egypt was very dry, naturally. So they had buried some bodies in the sand and discovered when they dug them up that the moisture had leached out of the body into the sand and that the bodies were very well preserved.
I had mentioned S.J. Wolf, talk about this as well. We were talking about the Egyptians. And if you didn't have the body, you had to have something else to preserve, I guess, as sort of a proxy for the body. They believed in something called the Ka. Is that how it's pronounced?
There were numerous things, but the Ka is the animating spirit of the body. And the Ka preferred to have the body, but if the body weren't available, because Egyptians believed in sympathetic magic and that if two things were similar or had the same characteristics, they could be the same magically. If you didn't have a body, you could have a statue, you could have a drawing, you could leave your name. If you wanted to really kill someone and not allow them into the afterlife, you destroyed the mummy, you destroyed their paintings, you destroyed their statues, or you gouged out their eyes, or you did things so that they would be incapacitated in the afterlife and not able to participate. Probably one of the most famous examples that I think more people are aware of would be the breaking and trying of statues of Hatshepsut, who ruled as king when females, that just didn't happen. And the heretic king Akhenaten, they tried to erase every trait and remnant of these people so that they could not, the Ka could find nothing to animate. And they could not live in the afterlife. But it's only in the afterlife. They don't come alive in this world. They come alive in this magical, the field of reeds, the western lands, whatever you want to call it.
Which will lead us eventually. I don't want to necessarily go there now, but that'll lead us to all these horror movies where you had these Egyptian mummies wandering around.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
In horror, because I think mummies are so interesting in literature and in popular culture. Heather Gilfroking, say something if you would about the importance of postures and positions. I mean, there are so many different dynamics of the way the way they were. Some were sitting, some were laid out, their arms in certain ways. Some had objects in their hands, I guess.
Right. And one of the wonderful things about this exhibition is that you get the chance to see a real variety of things. Now, we often visualize mummies as bandaged, wrapped in Egyptian and in that long body form that you usually see. But in fact, we have some beautiful South Americans, and it was very common in many cultures in South America to position the body in a seated position. So they would position the body and then they would tie it with a layer of textile around the knees and the back and around the head and then wrap that in multiple layers of fabrics and sort of keep them in that position. And that made the body very accessible and very portable because they would bring it out on family feast days or to consult. And so we see that position. We see others that are curled up in almost a fetal position. We have a wonderful Peruvian that's in an extended body position that's not common from South America. We also have in this exhibition a woman who has crossed legs.
Yeah.
And until recently, she was the only one we had found, but we now know of a couple of others from collections, so we can explore that. This woman...
Do we know what that means?
Not exactly. Initially, it was interpreted that she may not have been able to walk in life. She has some very severe damage to her spine because of tuberculosis. Huge parts of her vertebrae have been very heavily damaged. But in fact, that doesn't seem to be the case. This seems to have been a normal body position for that culture at that time. This woman also has wonderful crossed hands, and when we CT-scanned her, we could see that there were opaque objects in her hand. And when I modeled those in 3 dimensions, they look like Monopoly houses. And I thought, well, that can't quite be right. So I did a little more work with that. And we were able to print off those models in 3D to get exact scale replicas. And we had some people
Wow.
look at them. And they turned out to be the tops of teeth. So when you're Ooh. Born, you're born with the tooth crowns in your mouth. And then eventually they grow into the full teeth. These are the tooth crowns of young children. So we don't know if they were her teeth as a child or her children's teeth or somebody else in the community. But clearly the idea that she would take these teeth after her death and into her afterlife were really quite important in that culture. And we have other cultures at the time that we found, for example, small gold llamas and other things in their hands, but we've not come across a lot with teeth in their hands before. So I can't explain why they're there, but I'm fascinated by how important those were to her.
I guess this is what your work is like, unraveling these little mysteries.
Yes, but anybody who works with mummies will tell you that for every question I actually have an answer for, I generate two or three more.
Right.
And sometimes that's great. Other times I just kind of wonder about it. We have, for example, a howler monkey in a feather headdress and a feathered skirt. He's been stuffed with grasses but is generally naturally preserved. For the life of me, I don't know why he's wearing the feathered headdress and skirt, and it drives me crazy. I don't know if it's some sort of a joke about 150 years ago. They said, oh, let's mess with the anthropologist.
Right.
Or if they're really was a process that this was a revered creature. I truly don't have any evidence for it. I can't find another one like it. So,
S.J. Wolf, you too? You come up with more questions than answers when you're going through all of this?
Yes, I do. And it just seems the more I dig, the more I find. And that was part of the whole creation of my database, was to organize 10 filing cabinets full of information about Egyptian mummies. And it does. You start looking at where they came from and what happened to them, and you, the more information you get, the more it leads you to, well, okay, they did A, why did they do that? Why was Patty Hirschhoff always exhibited with a tattooed New Zealand chief head?
Wow.
He was, but we don't know why. And it didn't belong. Every museum that he went to had a tattooed New Zealand chief's head, which was a mummy in itself.
Yeah.
Why? They obviously were interesting, but every museum seemed to have one.
I wanted to talk about how our appreciation for mummies have changed over time. And there was a time, I guess, and S.G. Wolf, let me start with you because you've written about mummies in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for a time, a mummy in the 19th century was kind of like a tchotchke in some way. It was a collectible, I guess. It was a piece of art maybe even.
It really was more of a curiosity.
Hmm.
They were exhibited in traveling shows. There were not many actual museums that could exhibit a mummy. And museums weren't the cultural institutions that they are today. I mean, if you know, they were more sideshow cabinets of curiosity. And so the first mummies that came were exhibited in these display houses. They were exhibited in taverns. They were exhibited in public houses, the state house capitol, and in some cases in museums, but they shared their exhibit space with wax figures of hell or figures of the presidents of the United States or a mastodon skeleton. They were curiosities. This started to change during the science explosion in the 1840s and 1850s, where American scientists and ethnologists, and all over the world, but I speak primarily of Americans, wanted to know about human origins. Where did human beings come from? Where did the races of man come from? And so right about the 1840s, you start to see less of a curiosity factor and more of a scientific interest. But it isn't today's scientific interest where they're looking for evidences of disease or evidence of how the person lived or something of that sort. They were looking for evidences of ancestry.
Yeah.
Were the ancient Egyptians Caucasian? Were they Mongoloid? Were they Negroid? what were the criteria. And many of the mummy wrappings that occurred in the United States were centered around this kind of scientific, quasi-scientific inquiry.
So so people were looking to sort of confirm their sort of biblical, I guess, or maybe even religious or ideological or even racial ideas. They were looking to mummies to confirm those ideas.
Yes. One of the biggest conglomerate interests that I find is the biblical interest. Hmm. I can't begin to tell you how many of the early mummies I've looked at who were called the princess who saved Moses in the bulrushes.
Right.
This was a very familiar figure to most people, and it established an identity that people could then look at and imagine. Now, many people just went and looked at the mummies and said, oh, a mummy, how interesting. But there was a whole culture of people who wrote poems to mummies, who wrote poems about mummies, who tried to give them some sort of framework in which to examine them. My favorite one is one of a mummy that George Glidden unwrapped in Boston in 1850. He had a panorama of the Nile, and he bought four mummies to illustrate embalming and things such as that. He advertised that he was going to unwrap this daughter of a priest in Boston in 1850. And he got an amazing crowd of people at Tremont Temple. And this one unnamed poet in the Boston Atlas penned this very lengthy ode to this princess. She's transformed from the daughter of a priest into a princess, whose family mourns her, and she's young and she's beautiful, and her stalwart Egyptian military boyfriend weeps upon the broken stem of the lily of the Nile. And he goes on to describe her entire life. Well, it kind of took everybody by surprise, because Glidden, ever the showman, decided to take 3 days to unwrap the mummy, and by the time he had finished unwrapping it, it was quite obvious it was not a female. It had an erect penis. And the press had a field day with it. They just thought this was absolutely hysterical. And one man said, oh, well, I wasn't really disappointed that it wasn't a princess, because after all it was a damn cell, damsell. The 19th century Americans were just incredibly fond of puns.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these openings attracted all kinds of people, but starting in the 1850s and 1860s and 1870s, you begin to see more of an interest in the cultural connection. What can this person tell us about the past? What can it tell us about the Bible? You're looking at a person who lived in a time when the people in the Bible lived. That was an intriguing thought to a lot of 19th century Americans.
And I think, too, there were a lot of differences in how that was viewed in Europe. So SJ has given you the American perspective, but in Europe, the collector culture had a very different focus. They really were trying to build essentially natural history cabinets. And so a number of the mummies in this exhibition were part of a group of 20 that were from the Reis-Engelhorn Museums in Mannheim that had come from a painter by the name of Gabriel von Max. And Gabriel von Max was a massive natural history collector. He had hundreds, perhaps thousands at some point, of human skulls. He had mummies. He had preserved animals and humans, but a number of other things, with the idea of building his own natural history museum. And he wasn't alone at the time in Europe. So I think there was perhaps a slightly different focus for at least a lot of the time in building this collector culture. And I will say today, and you know, I'm sure SJ will confirm this, mummies are still highly collectible today. And this is disturbing. Part of the research that I'm involved in is looking specifically at the impacts of mummies in private collections and the heritage impacts of that and what we're really meaning.
We can't even begin to tell – I recall a conversation I had with Billy Jameson. Unfortunately, he has since died, the curator of the Niagara Falls Museum. He was licensed to deal in mummies and body parts. And he said to me, your database doesn't even begin to scratch the surface.
You can find advertisements for auctions of mummies and other human remains.
I know two people who have them.
Yes, and trading between collectors is rampant.
Well, so here's the thing that I think is interesting about that. On one hand, so you have people still trading or collecting them. But on one hand, you think, oh, they're preserving them. But there are so many stories from the 19th century where they were – in fact, we have an email from someone who had heard that in India or in some place they were burning mummies for fuel. And I guess in some way, S.J. Wolfe and Heather Gilfrecking, you can talk about this too, they were seen as commodities, bodies. And there's a section in your book, S.J. Wolfe, where you talk about the fact that they were actually using the cloth from mummies – to make paper in the 19th century.
Yes, it's mummy paper has always been thought to be a myth, as has been the idea that they burned the mummies in the locomotives. Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad, he calls out, damn these plebeians, they don't burn worth a cent, pass out a king, because they're burning the mummies to fuel the locomotives. We never had any firsthand evidence for this. Yeah. There's a lot of newspaper evidence. There's a lot, and it predates Twain, so it isn't Twain causing it. It predates Twain. It's tied in with the whole mummy paper thing. The United States was running out of rags. That's what paper was made from. They were experimenting with straw, grass, hemp, all kinds of other things, but it did not give the strength and the durability that rag paper gave. Isaiah Deck, whose father was a famous chemist in England, he came to America, and he was in Egypt looking for Cleopatra's lost emerald mines, and he saw mummy pits and all of this mummy cloth. And he really is the man who started the idea that they could take this mummy cloth and use it as linen for rag paper. There was a thriving industry in Alexandria. When they were building the Alexandria to Cairo Railroad, they had to lay the rails on rock. Can't lay it on sand, they're going to sink. When they were digging out the rail beds, they were finding caches of human and animal mummies. The small ones were used in the boilers. The larger ones went back to Alexandria, where there was a thriving business both with the natives and with American companies, who hired women and children to strip the rags off of the bodies and send them into the paper trade.
Wow.
The bodies were ground up for fertilizer, primarily for English rose gardens. Now, they came to America. We imported millions of tons of quote-unquote Egyptian rags.
And the bodies themselves, too. It's not just fertilizer. They were ground up for artist's pigment. The color mummy brown was originally
brown.
Contained.
Correct.
Was literally mummy
ground
brown.
Ground mummy. And, of course, bodies were also ground for medicine.
Wow.
I mean, up until 1930s, at least, Merck, we have price lists in the exhibition.
Yep.
Merck,
you can still
medical
buy it.
Industry.
Merck
was
powdered mummy.
Actively selling powdered mummy as a cure-all. So, you know, a little mummy is good for whatever ails you.
Yeah.
So, Heather Gilfrecking, does that make you sick?
You know, it's not so much that it makes me sick. That was the culture at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't have the right to judge that.
Imagine what has been destroyed. I mean, I guess there's nothing you could do about it, obviously, but that must make you
No, but
sick.
We know that the mummies that exist today, and that's part of the reason they're so incredibly precious, they are only a very small representation of what originally existed.
Yeah.
We can't even begin to comprehend what we've lost, not just from Egypt, but from other parts of the world.
Right. I mean, they estimate, you know, millions of mummies were stripped and sent. The rags were sent. The hotbed in America was Maine. Gardner, Maine had four paper mills that used almost exclusively mummy wrappings. And it's a little bit weird to actually hold a book that was printed on paper made from mummy wrappings, but it doesn't look or feel or smell any different than any other rag paper.
S.J. Wolfe is with us, author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. Heather Gill Frerking is Science and Education Director with the Mummies of the World exhibit, which opens on Saturday. It runs through May at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. For ticket information and more details, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the new exhibit at the Leonardo in Salt Lake City with all kinds of mummies. It's called the Mummies of the World exhibit. Opens on Saturday. You can go to our website for the particulars about that, and we'll give you more details as we go along. S.J. Wolfe is with us, the author of Mummies in 19th Century America. And we have with us here in the studio Heather Gill Frerking, Science and Education Director with the exhibit. And I wanted to ask you, Heather Gill Frerking, about the really unique case of the Buddhist mummies in Japan, Buddhist monks who, in essence, here's the term, self-mummify.
Right. This is a really interesting concept and certainly not something that we've seen elsewhere, to my knowledge. This goes back to, are you mummifying for yourself or for others?
Yeah.
And in this particular case, to achieve a certain level of enlightenment, to almost attain a deity-like status, monks from Japan would essentially begin to mummify themselves prior to death. So they would go to an isolated area, they would undertake prayer and contemplation, and they would eat a very specific diet that involved plants, roots, berries. I can't be specific about what it was, but they would do that. They would restrict fluids for a period of time. And then when the time came that they died, they had essentially begun to mummify themselves from the inside out. And a number of those bodies are still very well preserved in Japan. They're not necessarily available for study or research. They are, of course, religious objects.
So in some ways, they were sort of starving themselves to death?
To some extent, but they didn't – it wasn't so much that they were lacking nutrition. Essentially, they still had enough to live.
Yeah.
But they were taking in substances that helped to preserve the tissues in a way that would prevent decomposition and degradation. So, for example, a lot of the food that we take in today have chemicals that we may not be able to identify or are loaded with antibiotics or whatever it may be, that will affect the intestinal bacteria and how the body decomposes. Some of the work that I do is experimental archaeology. I bury piglets in peat bogs, dead piglets in peat bogs, and then I dig them up at periods of time to see how they have or have not preserved. And the difference between using a piglet that was fed that had died as a stillborn versus those that had eaten of an antibiotic hormone-raised pig, the preservation levels are actually different, or the decomposition
rates
are different.
In what ways? That's really
well, because there is gut flora in those that will have had milk to begin with, those that may have had access to antibiotics, the gut flora is different. So it affects the decomposition processes, and more work needs to be done in that area.
So let me ask you this. So in an era of, as you say, antibiotics and preservatives and processed food, let's say they were still preserving bodies like the Egyptians, it wouldn't work the same way, maybe?
Not necessarily. We have to really take into consideration how our body is accepting these foreign substances and what that's doing to our internal bacteria.
We should also point out, as you have, Heather Gill Frerking, that most of the mummies in the world weren't, in fact, intentional. They're natural mummies.
That's right. The vast majority of mummies that still exist today were naturally preserved. So there are a wide range of environments where natural mummification can occur. You need water for something to decompose, and you need oxygen for something to decompose. So if a body is in an environment where there's a limited amount of water or no oxygen, then there's a possibility it may preserve. No guarantee, but a possibility. So the bog mummies from northern Germany, they're in a wet environment, but they're usually below the water table, so it's an anaerobic environment. There's no oxygen, it's no decomposition. Where bodies are partially in that environment, they're only partially preserved. If you have any sort of a warm, dry environment, like a desert environment, and certainly I've talked to a number of people here who have found great things out in the Salt Lake area,
right.
You know, that great desert environment.
Salt, minerals, and dry air.
Between the salt and the dry air, exactly, these things will mummify and preserve. Cold, a dry environment. So we don't think about it, but the Arctic is a giant desert. And so any place where bodies can desiccate, that will allow natural preservation as well. So we have mummies in the exhibition, and we show you examples from a lot of different environments, from caves, from deserts, from bogs. we have this wonderful 500-year-old dog from a peat bog, and he's still fluffy and adorable.
Still fluffy. Talk about that one.
I mean, this dog is a little over 500 years old. We've just finished the research on it. You can't see his skeleton, but it's less than an inch thick. The weight of the peat has compressed it.
Wow.
And somebody thought it was a great idea when he was found in 1952 to give him a wash and basically a blow dry. And so he's now nice and fluffy. And I don't recommend this. If you come across anything mummified, it will only do it harm. But he really is wonderful. And he is the only surviving example of a three-dimensional animal from a peat bog. We have a few skeletons, but this is the only one with still flesh and fur on him.
What was it about mummifying animals? Was it about just our affection for pets, or was there some sort of religious significance?
Well,
we know?
It depends on when and where you're looking
sure.
at, too. I mean, clearly, and SJ can probably speak to the Egyptian side of things, but they were mummifying for a variety of reasons. They did mummify animals for food. They mummified them as offerings to the various gods. In other cultures, the animals were often just naturally preserved as part of that culture. So we have some wonderful fetal llamas, for example, from South America, or naturally preserved dog mummies from South America. And these were just part of the environment.
SJ?
Many of the Egyptian gods had animal attributes. And so the one that most people know about is Bastet or Bast, the cat goddess. And domestic cats, when they died, were sent to the city and embalmed and buried in catacombs. But they also raised cats to be sacrificed as offerings to the goddess. Crocodiles were mummified to honor the crocodile god Sobek. Baboons were mummified, baboons and ibises, to glorify Thot. Rams for Amun. Different animals were considered to be aspects of these gods, so they were preserved. There are examples of favorite pets.
Mm-hmm.
There's at least one prince who had an elaborate sarcophagus made for his favorite cat. And there's a couple of dogs that we know about that have been mummified and were put into the tomb of the Egyptians to bear them company in the afterlife. They would magically come alive in that field of reeds in the Western land.
Hmm. And we're talking sometimes about necropolis burial centers that may have had hundreds of thousands of animal mummies. So they've recently
yes.
found a site in Egypt that has hundreds of thousands of dog mummies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just an amazing find.
Yeah, some of the ibis mummies, they're in the millions. They don't even know how many
wow.
there are.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Stephen is with us. Stephen, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
I'm wondering if you could contrast sort of the historic take you've been doing on mummies with the more modern situation. You know, you look at the 20th century and political leaders with cult-like followings
yeah.
who are revered seem like they're frequently mummified and essentially worshipped for political purposes. People like Stalin and Lenin and Mao, Eva Perón, I think Ferdinand Marcos, probably many more examples.
Ho Chi Minh, I know, for sure. Yeah.
Right, I was just in China about a year and a half ago, and as part of that, I had the opportunity to see Mao on display, and it is, as a Westerner, it is a phenomenal experience. You line up for a very long period of time to access the tomb.
I've been there too, yeah.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to buy flowers and take them up and make offerings to Mao. They treat him as if he is a god. Unfortunately, the mummification of that particular body is not particularly good. And even from a distance, you can see that the body is essentially starting to deteriorate. And the way the lighting is not terribly flattering, I'm afraid, to term
Mao. Is the political use of mummies today, modern mummies, different than in nature than they were used historically?
That's a good question.
You know, I don't think so necessarily. When we consider that the South Americans, the Incas, as I said, used to parade their mummies through town, so those people were still prominent within the community after death, and in a lot of cases those were community leaders. So I think in some cases there were ancient traditions that allowed that to be used in the same way.
Yeah, I agree.
And SJ has talked about how they would destroy, for example, the images of Akhenaten, which was very clearly a political shift, in order to prevent his soul from continuing in the afterlife.
SJ, anything to add?
You could destroy it or you could preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
The great care that was taken by Panmunjom and the other high priests when they removed the bodies of the kings from the Valley of the Kings and hid them way up in the cliffs, and revered them. They were rewrapped. They had gold paint or yellow paint put on the coffins to imitate the gold that had been stolen. Yes, there's still a political thing there. These were their kings. When they brought the bodies out in the 1880s and brought them down to Cairo, the modern Egyptians lined up on the banks and mm-hmm. ululated and shot off guns in the air as if they would do at a modern funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not even Egyptians, they're Arab.
Let me come around to this because we're out of time, and I want to ask you both this finally. We didn't get a chance to talk much about mummies and horror films, but where are mummies today in our perspective, do you think? SJ, you first.
Well, I think when people think about mummies, the first thing they think about are the movies, the horror films, and the horror literature, and that dates back to the late 1800s when the Gothic idea came along, and everybody loves to be scared to death.
Yeah.
And let's face it, most of these mummies aren't very pretty. They're kind of horrific things. The one thing that I always make sure I tell audiences of children is that an evil mummy cannot exist. It just can't happen in Egyptian religion, and they don't come alive in this world. They come alive in a magic other world. So Hollywood and everything, it's a great thing to think about these bodies coming alive, and there again, I think that's one of the attractions. These bodies look as if they could get up and walk. What more horrible thing can you think of than a dead body coming after you?
Yeah.
It's the mummy and the zombie culture.
Yeah. Heather Gilfracking, less than a minute. Go ahead.
You know, I would say I've been working with mummies for close to 20 years, often late at night and in dark museums, and nothing has ever come to life, and nothing ever will.
Yes, exactly.
Heather Gilfracking, Science and Education Director for the Mummies of the World exhibit, which opens on Saturday. It runs through May at the Leonardo in downtown Salt Lake City. For ticket information and details, go to our website. Heather Gilfracking, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Doug.
And S.J. Wolf, the author of the book Mummies in 19th Century America. Thank you to you as well.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.